Ever since Diana Kennedy released the book The Cuisines of Mexico in 1972, she's been considered one of the leading experts on authentic Mexican cooking. Kennedy is originally from Britain. She moved to Mexico in 1957. She spent decades crisscrossing the country in search of recipes and new dishes and the perfect tamale. In the past, her books have focused on regional cuisines across Mexico. Her new book dives into the cooking of just one state, Oaxaca. NPR's Jason Beaubien caught up with Kennedy in her home in western Mexico.
Diana Kennedy's house is at the end of a dirt road that's only passable in a pickup truck or a four-wheel drive. This part of Mexico is quite lush at this time of year. Recent heavy rains have made her rambling gardens feel like a swath of jungle. On her 7 acres, she has fruit trees, apricots, oranges, figs. There's an overgrown corn patch. In raised beds, she's growing vegetables. Other plants that are scattered about like weeds are actually herbs. Vines crawl from one tree to another.
This chayote I brought back from the Sierra de Puebla. And you eat the vines as well as the chayotes.
Chayotes are pear-shaped vegetables that taste a bit like zucchini.
The local ones here, the ones that grow like wild over the trees, have spines on them, and it's a less compact flesh.
Kennedy's is a cook's garden. It's a repository for key ingredients for recipes from various parts of Mexico.
This is edible, and it's used with beans in Veracruz, part of Veracruz.
In the greenhouse attached to her home, she proudly declares that the only plants you can't eat are two orchids. The glass structure currently is overrun with chiles, red sweet ones and bright orange habaneros ready to be picked. In her kitchen, she's toasting dried chiles in a skillet.
This wonderful aroma comes up as you're doing this.
Kennedy is often referred to as the Julia Child of Mexico, an expatriate who's come to dominate the national food scene. At 87 years old, she's still fit and moves energetically around her kitchen. Traditional clay pots line one wall. Spices and vegetables hang in wicker baskets. The centerpiece of the kitchen is a long cement counter adorned with Mexican tile and topped with built-in gas burners. And if she happens to let you into her kitchen, you have to behave yourself.
Now, don't go over on the garlic, because most people put far too much garlic in Mexican food.
She's cooking a simple recipe of beans with yerba santa that comes from the western highlands of Oaxaca.
Not those great big elephant garlics you get in the States. It just drives me mad. I don't want to crush them down either. I don't like crashing it on the board and leaving all the flavor on the board.
Kennedy is a stickler for authenticity. She isn't just cooking to create a meal. She's cooking to preserve, to document dishes from remote parts of Mexico that are usually made entirely with local ingredients. She's crushing some wild oregano and cumin seeds in a stone molcajete.
Wonderful flavors come out of these, as you know. Don't ever overdo the cumin. We're not in the north, where the cumin is more predominant.
Her new book is called Oaxaca al Gusto. It's a cookbook with recipes, but it's not a conventional cookbook. At almost 7 pounds, it could also be a coffee table book or a textbook or a travel log in which this southern Mexican state is viewed through its food. Kennedy divides the book up not by recipes, but by geography, and she dives into the varied cuisines of this diverse state. She says this is what makes Oaxaca special.
Because of all these cultural differences and because of all these microclimates where you've got all these different ingredients that are used.
And she follows the local recipes religiously, using the chiles and other spices that are from that area. She's a food anthropologist. In her section on the Amuzgos, an indigenous group from the Pacific coastal region of Oaxaca, she writes, "Tamales, too, play an important role in their diet. They are filled with iguana, armadillo, goat, shrimp, mushrooms, beans, pumpkins, and even the black grubs known as cuetlas."
Now we can turn this down a bit.
The book even has a recipe for iguana and a mole sauce. Kennedy says she can already hear her critics in the U.S.
Okay, so they're going to say a lot of wild recipes that nobody can do in this book, but a lot of recipes you can do. And I want to say, how many recipes do you do in any cookbook? I swear you don't do half of them.
One that many people north of the border may skip is her recipe for a wedding stew from the Isthmus, in which you cut up a whole ox and boil for hours. But there are many simple recipes in this book, like the beans she's cooking. The chiles, garlic, cumin, and oregano are blended with a bit of water and an old electric blender.
In the bean pot, let's have that cook. I'm going to now, here are the beans. You see all soupy beans. And you want them, when you cook them, you do want some, leave the all that broth in it because the flavor's in the broth.
She adds the spices into lard that's sizzling in an unglazed earthen pot. Eventually, she'll put the pre-cooked beans into and let simmer. Right before serving, she adds rough chunks of fresh yerba santa leaves to the mix. The yerba santa gives a slight flavor of anise to the beans.
It'll go in just like this.
She serves the beans in fresh homemade tortillas with a bit of cheese crumpled on top. The chiles play off against the mild licorice taste of the yerba santa. Kennedy's new book is beautifully illustrated with luscious photos of raw ingredients, cooked meals, overflowing markets, and sweeping landscapes of Oaxaca. Her deep expertise is also the one downside of this book. The index is arranged geographically, making it hard to find a recipe unless you already know what part of the state it comes from. She also leaves out recipes for such staples as masa, the ubiquitous tortilla dough that's required in many recipes. But she makes up for these shortcomings by providing insight into the culture and history that accompany these meals. In the end, Kennedy delivers a collection of authentic, unusual recipes from one of the culinary hotspots of Mexico. Jason Beaubien, NPR News.
Hey, you can try Diana Kennedy's recipes for yourself. Just go to our website, npr.org. You can follow this program on Facebook and on Twitter. On Twitter, we're at Morning Edition and at NPR Inskeep. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
As China pours money into Greece, the jeans company Levi's is also making an investment, albeit far smaller, in Braddock, Pennsylvania. The town is being used as the backdrop for a new ad campaign. It was also where the post-apocalyptic movie The Road was filmed. Braddock was once a booming steel town. Today, it's a collection of abandoned homes and buildings, many with faded traces of past glory. In its campaign, Levi's is trying to evoke the Depression-era photographs of Dorothea Lange. The commercials are in black and white with a 1930s soundtrack.
This is all shot in Braddock, Pennsylvania, with people that live there and work there.
Tyler Wisnand is a creative director at Wyden & Kennedy, the same ad agency behind those old Spice commercials. These ones show people in Braddock working, ripping apart old houses, fixing up a roof.
It's the work they're doing to rebuild the town. We're also seeing parts of Braddock getting taken down. That's also part of the reality there. It's a broken town that this mayor, John Fetterman, has dedicated his life to rebuilding. And in fact, in the commercial, he'll step out and tell you exactly that situation.
90% of our town is in a landfill somewhere, so reinvention is our only option.
And he's really sort of the pioneer there that we really admire. When you enter the town, you get this feeling like, okay, we're going into a place that's, you know, suffering.
A few years ago, Rolling Stone magazine called John Fetterman the mayor of hell. Braddock's unemployment rate is about 30%. 20,000 people once lived there. Now, fewer than 3,000 do. Mayor Fetterman looks a bit like a pro wrestler. He's got Braddock's zip code tattooed on his arm. He's 6'4", and he wears a shaggy goatee.
Braddock and the whole Mon Valley, which it's a part of, was like the Silicon Valley of early last century. Extraordinary levels of wealth, prosperity, commerce. Braddock, which is really small from a geographic standpoint, two-thirds of a square mile, had over 14 furniture stores. I mean, three movie theaters, more than 50 restaurants, 45 churches, just the place where everybody in the valley went and did their shopping.
It's hard to imagine those times now. The biggest employer in town, a hospital, just shut down, taking 600 more jobs away. So Mayor Fetterman's had to sort of reinvent Braddock in part as a hardscrabble backdrop for Hollywood productions. It's not ideal, but it is a source of income for the town. Levi's pitched in to build a new playground and also a $1 million community center as part of the deal.
It's a space that didn't exist in town before Levi's stepped in. So the level of services that it's going to provide, you know, for Braddock's youth for the next 30 or 40 years, that's invaluable and priceless.
But there are critics, including Tony Buba, a lifelong Braddock resident. His problem is the way townspeople are portrayed in the ads.
I never knew there were that many thin people in Braddock until I watched those spots, or people with six-pack abs. I mean, you don't see anybody weighing 300 pounds and wearing a pair of Levi jeans walking across the screen.
Everyone who appeared in the ads was well-paid, that is, except for Mayor Fetterman. He did it for free. And as for the critics, Fetterman says he couldn't care less. As Braddock's mayor, he has to find money any way he can.
If somebody wants to give me $100 million, I'll kiss their ass and call it ice cream. But but seriously, it's about folks in the business community, you know, looking at communities that are struggling. And I like to think that this kind of private philanthropy, I'd like to see continue, because it really does deliver benefit in a way that, you know, government assistance and foundation assistance, you know, can't.
These pictures are very American, and yet sure. Levi's are not produced in America anymore.
Sure. You know, everybody agrees that we'd love to have these jeans produced in America. It's difficult because all of us participate in buying the lowest price goods often, and I never wanted to get involved in solving all of the ills of globalization. We just wanted to showcase the community. We wanted to create the community center here in town, and we wanted to do it in a way that is dignified for the community.
That's John Fetterman, the mayor of Braddock, Pennsylvania. The town is now being featured in a Levi's ad campaign called Ready to Work.
The Troubled Asset Relief Program, known as TARP, came to a formal end over the weekend. It was conceived, you'll recall, at the height of the financial crisis a couple of years ago as a lifeline for troubled banks. We called Wall Street Journal reporter Deborah Solomon and asked her what it means now that TARP is over.
What it means is that the government can no longer spend money on new programs or make new investments, but they still have about $165 billion outstanding, and that money's not being returned right away. They can continue to operate the program until banks and the other companies pay back what they owe.
Although already you've got an interesting bit of information there, because the figure that stuck in everyone's head was $700 billion. That's what Congress was asked for at the beginning in 2008. You said 165 is what is outstanding now. That's how much has been, loaned, lost? What is the way to think of it?
Well, it's funny. The $700 billion was probably the worst thing they could have ever done, because they never actually spent that much money. At the peak, I think they actually spent about $365 billion. They've gotten a lot of it back from the banks, and now they have a little bit left outstanding. They expect the program to ultimately lose $50 billion, which is far less than the $700 billion price tag that sort of stunned everybody in 2008 when Hank Paulson went up to the Hill to ask for that.
So almost half the money was never doled out. A lot of it has been returned, and it appears that the vast majority of it will be returned by the end.
That's right. And you saw that American International Group, which was one of the biggest bailouts that the government did, and one of the companies that nobody ever thought would get out from underneath the government's grasp, is actually starting on a path to repay the government. And that's one of the things that's going to help the U.S. recoup some of its losses quicker. And the government actually says it may make a profit on AIG someday.
Why did they pick $700 billion in the first place?
Well, that was the question everybody had. And remember, originally the program was to buy all these troubled assets, these toxic mortgages and things that banks had. And originally they sort of tried to come up with a number. How much would it cost the government to buy these assets? They picked $700 billion, and that's what they asked for.
Just because seven is a lucky number, I imagine.
I guess, although it turned out not to be so lucky, because it became known as the $700 billion bailout. And I think that's one of the things that has made the public so angry about this, is that it's just a huge sum of money. People thought it was this blank check. And as it turns out, they've spent far less than they expected to.
There are already senators and congressmen who've retired rather than defend their vote for TARP. And there are other lawmakers who are in danger of losing their jobs over it this fall.
Well, this is a huge political liability. I mean, you've seen in many races that TARP has become an issue. In Texas, Rick Perry was calling Kay Bailey Hutchinson Kay Bailout Hutchinson. It has just become sort of a lightning rod. Any politician who is in a re-election campaign, even Barney Frank, is having to defend their vote for this program.
Well, we should remember this is a program that was passed under a Republican president, President Bush, and it did get a number of Republican votes as well as Democratic votes at the time.
It did. And, you know, I mean, Henry Paulson actually had to go, he was a Treasury Secretary at the time, actually had to get the Democrats to back him, because Republicans were wary of it at the time. But you saw, you know, the House House Republican leader and others rally behind it. And you still have some Republicans who say it was a good thing, but more often than not, the Republicans are seizing on TARP. It's become a metaphor for everything people hate about the government. So you're seeing Republicans who have no choice but to say that TARP is bad.
Well, should we reconsider the underlying facts? I mean, arguments can be left to the politicians, but are the underlying facts different than we thought if it turns out that the cost of this program is more like $50 billion instead of $700 billion?
Well, I mean, it's always hard to tell people that things would have been worse without this. You know, Ben Bernanke, the Federal Reserve Chairman, went up to the Hill and said, "This is Armageddon. We wouldn't be asking for this money if we weren't on the brink of total collapse." And at the end of the day, most people agree that if they hadn't done this, the recession would have been much worse, much deeper. We could have 20% unemployment instead of 9.5% unemployment. But again, it's very hard to tell people that things would have been much worse when things already feel so bad.
Deborah Solomon of the Wall Street Journal, thanks very much.
Thank you.
At age 9, Demetrius Walker was dunking basketballs into 10-foot-high rims. By the time he reached 11, Demetrius was signing autographs. 6 years before he was old enough for college, he got his first recruiting letter from the University of Miami. And as an eighth grader, he made the cover of Sports Illustrated. Big shoe companies were clamoring to have Demetrius wear their gear, and much of the hype was generated by the man who discovered and then later abandoned Demetrius Walker. His name is Joe Keller. Sports writer George Dorman spent 8 years hanging around Keller, Walker, and the cutthroat world of youth basketball. He tells a story in his new book. It's called Play Their Hearts Out. And George Dorman joins me from San Francisco. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Most of us are somewhat familiar with the kind of high stakes involved in recruiting college basketball players, but your story starts way earlier than that. I mean, these are kids as young as 8, 9 years old playing what you describe as grassroots basketball. First of all, can you explain what this is?
Basketball is this sort of unregulated world where anybody can wake up tomorrow and start a club basketball team, recruit players, and start playing. And the best of these teams get sponsored. They're sponsored by the shoe companies, by other people, and they travel the country playing games. So there's no leagues necessarily or, you know, regions that they play under. They're sort of national teams looking for the best players, showcasing the best players.
You tell the story through Joe Keller, who was this sort of regular guy. He was in his mid-20s in the Inland Empire in Southern California. He basically scours playgrounds in his neighborhood in the area to find talented prospects to set up a team, and he basically begins to do this, and anybody can do this.
Yeah, when Joe got into coaching, I mean, he couldn't even demonstrate a proper defensive stance. He just was a competitive guy, one day figured out he could start a team, he did that, and then he went out and went to middle schools, elementary schools, playgrounds, rec centers, and he looked for those athletic kids that he felt would project to be great players. Maybe they were tall or fast, but he was sort of looking for that one or two things that, you know, held the promise of greatness.
Joe Keller is portrayed in this book as, I guess it's fair to say, a pretty extreme person. He's not a particularly skilled teacher. He seems to take advantage of these young kids to make big money, or in his attempt to make big money, yet the kids and their parents basically trust him. How did he win them over?
Early on, Joe, I think, was sort of half good guy, half greedy. He did do some wonderful things for the boys. He, you know, he fed them, he clothed them. For Demetrius and a few others, he was truly the only father that they ever knew. So there were some redeeming qualities about Joe. But he also held this carrot out there for kids. He understood how parents, how kids dreamt of college scholarships and of the NBA. And he put that out there. He said, if you trust me, I can get your kid there.
Joe Keller eventually discovers a player named Demetrius Walker. From the time this kid is 10 years old, he's basically being touted as the best player in the country at his age. Joe basically stakes his sort of future on this kid, thinks that this kid is his golden ticket. And they develop this very odd relationship, sort of part father-son, part agent-star. How did that happen?
I think Demetrius was a, you know, kind of an old soul. He was a kid, a latchkey kid who had to grow up very fast. And Joe, at the same time, was certainly immature. They sort of came to each other, you know, Joe coming down and Demetrius going up. And their roles would kind of flop back and forth at times. You know, they were father and son. There's no question about that. But they were friends, older brother, younger brother. They just spent so much time with each other. I mean, they were never apart. So as they go forward, they kind of grow together. And really, you know, their relationship is something that I had never seen before because it wasn't coach-player. It wasn't just father and son. It was so many things.
You basically watched him grow up, I mean, from a child to a young man. He eventually fell out with Joe Keller. How did this kid go from being Joe Keller's golden ticket to this kid that he basically froze out?
Well, two things sort of happened simultaneously, which was, one, Demetrius started to struggle as a player. He didn't have a growth spurt after 14 like Joe anticipated, so he stayed right around 6'2". And he needed to become a perimeter player, a guard, and Joe wasn't preparing him. And at the same time, Joe was making crazy money. He had come up with this idea to run all-star camps for 6th, 7th, and 8th graders. And he would sell merchandise off these camps. He had Adidas was sponsoring his camps. He was making crazy money. And at the same moment, his star was flopping. So he made this choice. He said, I'm going to take care of my family. I'm going to step away from the team and from Demetrius and just focus on my camps and making money. And it was easier to do that when Demetrius was flopping because he now saw, well, I'm not going to make any money off this kid anyway, so c'est la vie, Demetrius, and I'm going to move on to the camps.
My guest is George Dorman. He's the author of a new book called Play Their Hearts Out. It comes out this week. I think a lot of people listening to this interview would be surprised. I certainly was when I was reading this book, to find out that shoe companies, I mean the big shoe companies, Reebok, Nike, Adidas, are watching these kids, these 9 and 10-year-old kids play and are trying to sort of get in there early on, and that these coaches like Joe Keller and others that you talk about are making a lot of money off of this.
We've long known that the shoe companies have worked to get in with kids who were high school age kids. They've sponsored their coaches or given their coaches money to make sure that the best high school age players, you know, wore Nike or Reebok or Adidas. But what Adidas did was they identified Joe's team, Demetrius, and a couple other star players before they reached high school. And they sponsored Joe Keller. They made Joe Keller one of their signature coaches. And this was a monumental shift. It was the shoe companies sort of crossing this hard deck that no one had crossed before, which was, we're going to market 7th and 8th graders. You know, there's a scene in the book where one of Adidas's grassroots executives talks about, you know, we want the market on Demetrius. We want to, you know, people that wear his shoes. And so this was stunning, and it just showed you how far they're willing to go.
And I should point out that this still goes on. And so I'm wondering who polices all of this. I mean, it's certainly not the NBA. The NCAA isn't really paying attention to it. So how is it allowed?
Just because of the reasons you said, there are no police. You know, there's no organization, no state organization, no national organization that runs youth basketball. It is a completely unregulated subculture. So, you know, I can start a team tomorrow. I can start paying kids. I can get an Adidas deal. All of these things go on, and nobody at any point can step in and say, you know, stop this. And the only people who really have the control are the shoe companies because they control the purse strings.
And Demetrius Walker is in college now. He's about to enter his sophomore year at New Mexico, right?
Yeah, he played last year at Arizona State and then transferred to New Mexico, where they play a little more fast-paced. And he's doing okay compared to some of the other boys in the book who fell out, and also just given what he went through. He really recognizes how he was taken advantage of. He recognizes that he has some serious scars and some things to overcome. But by recognizing that, he now knows, you know, this is the things I need to do to maybe, you know, get back to where I was.
What's Joe Keller doing now?
He's running his camps. He's making his money that way. But his competitive nature, which is amazing, is now focused almost entirely on his son, Jordan, who I think is around 9 or 10, his baseball career. He's got him playing club baseball. He's got a team called Team Phenom, which is a name that sort of resembles some of the things that Joe did with the basketball team. So it's amazing. I could probably sit down right now and start another book about Joe Keller and youth baseball, because it's almost like that journey is at the starting point.
That's George Dorman. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer for Sports Illustrated and the author of the new book, Play Their Hearts Out. It comes out this Tuesday. George Dorman, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.